Welcome to the Savvy Shrink Podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom and crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to The Savvy Shrink.
Hello, and welcome to The Savvy Shrink. We are very honored to have Carrie Fannin here today, and it's just wonderful to be able to share in a dialogue about her work. As a parent of a child diagnosed with Asperger's disorder, learning disabilities, and sensory processing disorder, Carrie Fannin is a strong advocate for vulnerable children and a successful community mobilizer. Soon after her daughter's initial diagnosis in 2000 at age 6, she became a volunteer for the SPD Foundation, now known as the STAR Institute for Sensory Processing, a research foundation dedicated to sensory processing disorder located in Denver, Colorado. Along with another parent who was living in New Hampshire, Carrie volunteered to help grow what became a grassroots network with active groups in more than 80 U.S. communities and several foreign countries. These families accomplished what they did primarily online and through virtual means, 3,000 miles away from one another. Carrie was later appointed to serve as the program's international parent coordinator, a position she held for 5 years, working to recruit and support the parent volunteers who would establish and grow groups in their own neighborhoods and communities. In her own community in Washington State, Carrie began hosting in-person support group meetings for families like hers in King County in early 2001. Her local support group shared resources and families learned how to advocate for their children in their schools. Carrie steadily grew the support network to 250 families in Washington State, and in mid-2009, she founded Sensory Planet, an international online community for parents of children with special needs. Today, Carrie's social media reach now exceeds 100,000 individuals from all parts of the world. She continues to participate and interact with families seeking support and information. Her family story serves as proof that things do get better and that there is help and hope for these children and their families. Carrie left a successful 25-year career in community banking in 2012 to accept the position as executive director at Children's Institute for Learning Differences, or CHILD, a non-public agency located in Renton, Washington. CHILD is a three-component, 501c3 nonprofit organization that provides therapeutic day school services and pediatric clinical services for students and private clients K-12, and support and training services for parents and professionals. Carrie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Please let our listeners know a little bit more about your fabulous work and how you came to be a passionate advocate for children with special needs, sensory processing disorder in particular.
Well, my story begins actually 23 years ago when I had my first and only child, a little girl, and we had a number of very confusing years trying to figure out what was going on with this beautiful and ridiculously brilliant child who couldn't seem to find any comfort in her environment. She was continually tantruming and melting down. Our world got exceedingly small in terms of the places that we could go, the places that we could take her or not take her. I became hyper vigilant and watching every move that she made because she was so unpredictable that I could have her in my eyesight in one moment and the next moment she could be a half a block down the road. So it really was, you know, trying to find our way with what it was that was making this little girl tick and finding a way to help her find some comfort and coping that this work really began for me. So it really, for me, was as a parent struggling to figure out what was going on with her baby. And you know, that journey really took me 6 years before I had any answers. Wow. 6 years of asking doctors and pediatricians and my family and friends for help, because this little girl was just in a constant state of distress. And once I had some answers that came through a pediatric neurologist, that really began our path to helping her. And the first diagnosis that my daughter had was sensory processing disorder. And in those days, it wasn't called that. It was actually dysfunction of sensory integration, which is a mouthful. But that really is, that's where it all started for me, was with my own child.
Wow.
And it's morphed, you know, 23 years later into something very different, including family support and education and advocacy for families who are raising children with sensory processing challenges.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Your work is really remarkable, and you're truly a pioneer in really creating lemonade out of a lemon situation and shaping an adverse situation into one of advocacy and finding information for not only your family's needs, but helping other people out. So it's fantastic the work that you have done, and you're really leading the charge in that area and have done so for quite some time. So I think this is really poignant information, because sensory processing disorder, I think, is so much more common than people really know. And, you know, it can look like so many different diagnoses. My own son, who happens to be in middle school now, I have two sons, but one has auditory and visual processing challenges. So we're working on helping him with that piece. But it certainly looks different at different ages and stages, and there can be confusing diagnoses for sure. So that leads me to my next question. If a parent suspects that their child might have sensory processing disorder, or something like that, what do you recommend that they should do?
That's a great question, and it varies, you know, city to city, state to state in this country. But I would say that if you're thinking that there may be something going on with SPD, the first thing that I would say to families or mothers or dads is to trust your gut instinct. You know your child better than anybody. And I think, you know, having been turned away so many times myself, I would say just, you know, be persistent, be insistent that if a doctor is telling you every child's different, there's different developmental stages for all children, all of those things are true, but what you as a parent know needs to be acknowledged and honored. And if you need a referral, if you want a referral, if you want to see a specialist, continue to push for it. You know, there's a lot of information online. There's no question, but if your child has a sensory processing disorder, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be able to self-diagnose and treat without some professional intervention. So, you know, it depends on the city that you're in. Sometimes they're developmental pediatricians. Sometimes they're pediatric neurologists. You know, occupational therapists cannot diagnose SPD, but they can sure do an assessment and be able to confirm whether or not it's present. So it really is going to be dependent on what the needs of the family are first, as to what route makes the most sense. But I would truly, the message is to trust your gut and keep pushing. If you know something isn't right, keep asking and keep pushing forward until you get the answers that you need.
That's great advice. And so starting with a pediatrician or even the school district, if the child, at least in California, is three and over, a child is eligible to have an IEP and an assessment if there is a suspicion of a learning challenge of some kind. But I think you're spot on through the medical system, through a physician, through the school district, and you're highlighting the significance of trusting the parent's gut instinct. If you have that sense or that intuition that something is a little bit off or a lot off with your child's development, it's critical to get the support in place while your child is young so they can have access to resources that might help shape the brain in a direction of neuroplasticity and evolving in a direction of, you know, some additional support services, which we can talk about later. But I think you suggest, you know, really homing in on one's gut instinct as a parent is critical, and not to ignore that gut instinct. With that, what are some signs of sensory processing challenges in young children that we can look out for? And what have you seen with your daughter or with other kids that are potentially some signs of SPD in young kids?
Sure. So I think there are a number of things that by themselves, you probably look and think, well, that's sort of innocuous or that's kind of a benign thing. What you're really looking at is sort of in total, mm-hmm. right? Because all of us sensory preferences. We maybe don't want to go to, you know, a busy warehouse store in the middle of Christmas, or, you know, crowds may be an issue for you, or bright lights. There are lots of things that we have preferences about, but what you're looking for, I think, is when the symptoms in total begin to impact or impede everyday life. Mm-hmm. So things like tags in clothing, seams in socks. Maybe your child won't wear shoes. Maybe they won't wear socks. Maybe they won't put a coat on regardless of the weather. Maybe it's freezing cold outside and they won't wear a coat and you touch them and their skin isn't cold. Putting their hands over their ears kind of with a startle reaction to mm-hmm. unexpected noises. You know, something coming into their visual field unexpectedly that creates a startle reflex. Mm-hmm. Changing schedules that create, you know, we say we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this. And we adults are great at changing plans at the last mm-hmm. minute and thinking that everybody can adapt as quickly mm-hmm. as we can. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, you know, knowing that something is supposed to happen in the way it does, and when it doesn't, you don't get disappointment. You don't get a sulky or a pout. You get a full-on scream meltdown that can last for a long time without seemingly any way to comfort a child. Mm-hmm. All of these, again, if you look at them individually, you think, well, that's 2-year-old behavior. That's 5-year-old behavior. That's, you know, I don't like tags in my clothing. But when it starts to impact daily living, I think is when you start looking and saying, wow, there's a lot more going on than I don't want a tag in my clothing. There are a lot of things collectively that are creating some discomfort and uncomfortable situations for my child.
Yes, I think that's really astute observation for sure. And it's like the key piece is that it's interfering with their functioning, or it's causing potentially some anxiety or some distractibility, whatever sensory input, it might be overstimulating or understimulating. For some children, they might be sensory seekers and they have to have more contact with proprioception, feeling their joint muscles and pressure on joint muscles. So what looks like a hyperactive child might be a kid that's just understimulated and needs to feel more sensory input in their joints, or a child could be overstimulated and it's trying to figure out that balance for the child to have their sensory system integrated. And like you said, we all as human beings have delicate sensory systems, but some of our young people are born with an under or overstimulated system. And, you know, and that can be challenging for learning. And that's often when we see it surfacing significantly, is either through behavioral issues that are really sensory driven, or through academic challenges, issues with problems with focus and concentration, because of their sensory input is challenged in some way, shape, or form. It makes it very difficult to attend to, you know, conversations if they have an auditory processing challenge, or visually track something. So it becomes very complicated. But with that,
it does.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. It's overwhelming, I think, for not only for the child, but for the parent, because you want to be able to help your kid and maybe don't know exactly how to help your child. But in your experience, what are the common interventions that have been helpful for children with SPD? What have you found that's most helpful in navigating SPD?
Well, in my daughter's case, mm-hmm. sure, primary intervention and the one that made the most significant impact on her life was occupational therapy.
Yes.
No question.
Yes.
Now, we certainly along the way did a whole lot of complementary interventions, things that, you know, but sort of I reached a point where I was sort of like, you know, if it's not harmful, you know, and it possibly is going to give her a little relief, I'm willing to try it.
Right.
You know, we did, you know, massage therapy and cranial sacral therapy. I mean, we sort of did we did acupuncture, you know, I mean, there were just things along the way that I thought, well, if it doesn't hurt and it might help, there's no, you know, scientific evidence today. I can't even tell you how many diet changes and adaptations that we tried, none of which made any impact, unfortunately, on really what I started looking at, which was more of the behavioral responses to things. And I think for me, doing these things and not getting the, you know, the intended outcomes or the promised outcomes sort of put me at a place where I realized that there isn't a magic pill. Some things are going to work for some kids, some things won't. Doesn't mean that if it works for your family, you know what, if you think that red dye is making a big difference in your child's behavior, go for it. You know, there's no reason not. I think for me, where it gets a little dicey is the promises of, you know, miraculous results with a broad brush, you know, of broad strokes. So they weren't particularly impactful for my daughter's life. Occupational therapy changes the brain.
Yeah.
And it does make a difference. Mm-hmm. So I think, oh, frankly, when people ask, where should I start? That's where you start.
Okay.
That's the foundational work that you do. If you don't have a child who's in a regulated state, body regulated, thoughts regulated, you know, all of these things, it doesn't really matter what you pile on top of that. You're not going to have the results that you're looking for if you don't have a child that's regulated.
Exactly.
They're not going to be able to attend to an academic instruction. They're not going to be able to, you know, try speech therapy with a dysregulated kid. That's fun. You know, so there's just a lot of things that occupational therapy is job one. You've got to get that first. And then the things that you're looking at, other therapies are highly, much more highly likely to have the results that you're looking for, because you've got a kid who's attending to it rather than, you know, kind of spinning out of control.
Exactly. I found occupational therapy to be so helpful for my son. Absolutely. And it's such a valuable intervention. And so I think it's important for parents to be helpful, that really that can be transformative, because it's so easy to get stuck and wondering about what does this mean for my child's future? How are they going to be able to fully function? And, you know, there are some really great targeted interventions through occupational therapy that are very beneficial. But in your experience, would you say that the outlook and prognosis is good for kids with SPD and other learning challenges with these specific interventions?
Absolutely.
That's good to know.
Absolutely. And the that have been made in occupational therapy over the last 20 years have been startling. They really have made, you know, when my daughter, I'll give you an example, when my daughter was in occupational therapy, she was in private therapy for 5 years. 5 years, weekly OT. You know what? We know today that isn't necessarily, you know, the third protocol. There's a lot of work that's being done, research and treatment in Colorado by the Star Institute for Sensory Processing Disorder, that intense therapies, you know, over a short period of time rather than weekly or monthly, but daily for, you know, a period of time, has much more dramatic results for kids than, you know, than the protocol that my daughter went through. She had an awful lot of therapy. And I do want to make, you know, a distinction between private therapy and school-based therapy. They are wildly different.
Okay.
They have very different outcomes that they're working toward. And so kids who get occupational therapy in school only, that's a tough one. You know, their school-based OTs are working to make sure that these kids can be present and attend in school. Can they hold a pencil? Can they in their chair? Can they regulate? Very different than the occupations of childhood that we families live with 24 hours a day, right?
Exactly.
School-based
OTs,
sleep. They're not going to help you with feeding issues or sleep or toileting, you know, it's just a different approach.
Definitely. And that's brings me to my next question. How would someone find those interventions? It sounds like, you know, through public schools, there's a cursory amount of OT that can be available depending upon if the child is eligible for the service, but that they really need something more in some circumstances or in many circumstances.
Right.
So where would a parent find those outside resources? And would it be something that's local to their community, or are there specific agencies that a parent might want to consider looking into for targeted occupational therapy for their child?
Sure. So you actually mentioned something earlier, which was school districts and early intervention. Mm-hmm. That wasn't part of my reality because it took, you know, my child wasn't diagnosed until she was in first grade, which is so late.
Okay.
So I didn't know that in my state, early intervention was a possibility. And it is. It is in every state.
Mm-hmm.
Birth free programs are available. You know, the kids that are going into school districts with disabilities are being treated prior to that. If the families know about it, if you've got a pediatrician who kind of recognizes that those kinds of interventions can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's so tricky with SPD is that people are really great at interventions with disabilities that they can see.
Mm.
So the kids who have physical disabilities or cognitive impairments tend to get plugged into these resources very quickly.
Mm.
And children are who you can't see the disability.
Right.
What you see is probably what people would categorize as a behavior issue, which is just a trigger for me.
Totally.
So they're missing that. They're mm-hmm. missing that, you know, that early intervention services are mm-hmm. available. So I would say Google's your friend right now. Mm-hmm. If you don't know where to go, Google early intervention services in your state
mm-hmm.
and start there. There's okay. lots of pediatric clinics and people that you can get connected to.
Fabulous. That's really good information. And I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, your daughter received services when starting at about 6. I think it's incredible that you were in tune to know that something was different with her at that time. And even at age 6, there can be so much change that can happen with occupational therapy. So it's really never too late. And I think it's easy for parents to beat themselves up kind of for not getting interventions early enough because they didn't know what they know now. But I think we just do the best we can with the information we have and also the resources that are available to us. And I think it's just remarkable and wonderful that you're on this pioneering journey to help other people to really know what SPD is. And it truly is an invisible disability. It's not something that's really obvious on the outside. And so often children are overlooked unless there is a parent or a caregiver knows what to look for. So I think having the awareness of some of the signs and symptoms of what to look for is essential, and really appreciate your sharing that information with our listeners. It's really good information. And I think a lot of parents also struggle with a sense of feeling like they failed their child or not knowing where to go. They're just drowning with overwhelm. And I think it's important for special needs parents to have additional support because it's such a taxing journey. What advice do you have for special needs parents that may have a child with SPD?
I think that the first thing that I try to impress upon a family when I'm talking with them or even working with them is, first of all, sensory processing disorder is not parental.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't parental.
That's right.
It is a neurodevelopmental disorder. It's not your fault. And probably more important than that is that you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the catalyst for me. What drove me into doing something in my community was that I truly thought that I had a very unique situation with my daughter. You know, I didn't know anybody who struggled with parenting the way that I did. And I truly did think it was parenting, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they were telling me. Well, mm-hmm. Oh, is this your first baby? Yeah, it is. It is my first baby. But, you know, I couldn't quite connect the dots between this is your first baby and that's why you've got a child who you can't get dressed, you can't sit in a car seat, who won't sleep, Right. Who screams hours upon hours. Lots of things didn't seem to kind of connect with bad parent. You know, look at families who have more than one child and only one has SPD. How is the parenting different?
Exactly.
You did a great one, but then you decided you were going to do something. You were just going to go rogue on the second one and try something new, and that didn't work. And of course, you must be a bad parent then. Right.
Good points. And I think you speak to something so important that a lot of parents do internalize this sense of feeling like they are bad parents, when in fact, like you said, it's not a parenting issue. It's a neurodevelopmental concern. And with interventions like occupational therapy, a child can really self-regulate very well. But it is a taxing journey, and parents really do need that support, because unfortunately, children with special needs that are acting out behaviorally or having some academic challenges can be subjected to judgment by people that just really don't have the information about SPD. You know, a child could have a meltdown in a Target store and, you know, the parent is looked at with accusatory, blaming, and shaming glances by passersby. And that can feel really overwhelming for parents that really need the help in supporting their child to evolve and grow into their highest potential. So I think when you say they're not alone, that is absolutely the case. And what is the ratio? Is it 1 in 6 children have SPD or somewhere in that zone? I'm trying to remember what that
is. Yeah, you know, I think that the last verse that I saw was mm-hmm. that 1 in 6 have challenges, not necessarily, you know, sensory challenges that are significant enough to impact their daily living.
Uh-huh.
That's a lot.
That's, you know, a lot.
That's 1 in every classroom.
Absolutely.
For sure, right?
Absolutely. That's a lot of kids. And a lot of parents that are dealing with this.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, one of the things that's so difficult when you're working with a diagnosis of SPD is it isn't widely recognized,
mm-hmm.
which it's just amazing to me after 40 some odd years of research and therapy interventions that we on this path of sensory processing are truly following in many ways the same path that families who have children with autism did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's discounted. That's not real. That's not, that doesn't exist. It's not a real diagnosis.
Hmm.
You know, there's a lot of things that are thrown back at families that have absolutely nothing to do with the way that their child is reacting and behaving to sensory input.
Exactly.
It's really, you know, we're shortchanged. That's not real. How does that help me that you don't think this is real? This is what I'm dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And something isn't in a medical manual somewhere. And by the way, it's just one medical manual. There
right.
are many others, and there are others that sensory processing is mentioned in. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, we really have to kind of get off of that dialogue and focus on what does this child need?
Definitely.
And, you know, parents need to have the space to grieve a little bit.
Yes.
You know, this is not something that any of us dream about or think about for the baby book when we're having children or
That's
adopting
right.
children or children coming into our lives. And we don't get a manual
mm-hmm.
for this. We really are out kind of in the Wild West trying to navigate a confusing diagnosis and disorder in many, many, many cases, not very helpful professionals
yes.
who are kind of blowing things off
mm-hmm.
and all the while a baby who is struggling.
Yes.
And if you think there's impact on that child and the family and any other sibling, you're wrong.
Absolutely.
Because it is.
It is. It's hugely impacting. And I think you highlight that so significantly that this population needs a lot of support, and it is actually much more common than we realize. And so having some compassion for a parent who may be struggling with trying to understand their child's behavior or sensory sensitivity can go a long way. With that, do you have any recommendations for our listeners? It would be a really good introductory book on SPD or website that would kind of give an overview of what sensory processing disorder is. Do you have favorite book titles or websites that you think would be helpful?
Oh gosh, I do. I probably have more than we could even probably get to today, but I would say that start first with a website, you want to go to the Star Institute for Sensory Processing Disorder. It might not sound familiar. This agency has been around for 40 years, but they've been through a number of name changes. Mm-hmm. When I got involved with them, they were the Kid Foundation. They then moved to the SPD Foundation, and I think their last name change went to the Star Institute for Sensory Processing Disorder. They're in Denver. They are the premier resource for research and intervention and treatment for sensory processing disorder.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. Wonderful. And that's a great resource. And how about books like by Carol Kranowitz, The Out of Sync Child? I know that kind of helped me a little bit. It was sort of like a primer in terms of understanding a bit about what sensory processing disorder can look like, and it can look different with each child. Do you find that book is helpful?
The Out of Sync Child was the first book that was put in my hands after my daughter was diagnosed within a couple of. And yes, I would say that a whole lot of light bulbs went off when I read Carol's book. My copy is quite dog-eared at this point and with a highlighter. I would also say that Lindsay Beale's book, Raising a Sensory Smart Child, a book she co-wrote with Nancy Pesky, is really phenomenal.
Great.
Just really great book for parents. Mm-hmm. There are a ton of books, you know. It's kind of like you reach a point where you're, do you want to read something that's a little bit more academic in terms of the research, mm-hmm. or are you looking at something that's going to help a family day to day? I would say that those books are probably your go-tos to begin with.
Okay.
There's some really great books for kids that you can read to your kids. I like birthdays. It's the Parties I'm Not Sure About. Is really good children's book about SPD that was actually written by one of my dear friends and the founder of Parent Connections many, many years ago that I've worked with forever.
Wonderful.
Lori Ranke. And then for school-age kids, elementary-age kids, truly one of my favorites is This is Gabriel, Making Sense of SPD, written by Hartley Steiner. Again, just really, really good nuts and bolts books that kids can understand about why they may struggle with things that their friends don't. So I think they're really good books to help normalize for kids this experience, and for sure normalizing parenting experience for families. So I think those are probably my first, you know, off the top of my head. Lucy Miller has written a number of books as well. She's the founder of the Star Institute for SPD. So lots of really good resources that are out there.
Thank you for that. That is wonderful. And Carrie, how can our listeners contact you or find you online? Do you have a website or a way in which you can be contacted if someone were to want to ask more questions or learn more about the work that you're doing?
Sure. I spend probably the majority of my work with families is through social media these days. What started as in face in Washington State, which is where I live, with, you know, a dozen or so families, has turned into an online presence that is starting to get a little large these days. But I would say probably the best way to connect with me initially, and then we, you know, if somebody wants to connect by phone or through my private email, I can certainly provide that to them once we connect through Facebook.
Wonderful. We really appreciate your time and your expertise. I know our listeners are in for such a great treat hearing this podcast today, and I think it will help many people be pointed in a direction to help their child with SPD and also to help themselves. So thank you for your pioneering work and for imparting us with your wisdom today. Really appreciate your time.
It was my pleasure to be here, and I thank you for allowing me the opportunity. And just remember, it gets better. I promise it gets better.
Oh, that's great words of wisdom. Thank you so much, Carrie, and thank you for being on the Savvy Shrink podcast.
I sure appreciate it, Andrew. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to The Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com or visit my website at andreaschneiderlcsw.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time.